Hello, I'm Gemma Gracewood, and you're listening to The Letterboxd Show, where we bring a rotating cast of Letterboxd regulars together to talk about film and everything else that's going on right now. Hello, this is The Letterboxd Show. I'm Gemma Gracewood, the editor of Letterboxd, and joining me today from LA is writer and director of community for The Blacklist and the co-host of The Blacklist podcast, Kate Hagen. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, we're excited to have you. And in Montreal, we've got freelance contributor Justine Smith, who writes for Roger Ebert, Hyperallergic, and The National Post. How are you in Canada?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we do like to start with a bit of a mental well-being check on the podcast because these are extraordinary times. How are you? How are you both? What's going on where you are?
Hanging in there, tired of my own cooking. No, I feel very lucky to be in a state in California that has taken the COVID-19 crisis really seriously from the outset and feel very lucky to have remained connected to all of my friends and family, no matter where they are in the world.
It's a beautiful, optimistic outlook on it all. Yeah.
That's what I got today. Ask me tomorrow and it won't be as optimistic. It's fine.
One day at a time. How about you, Justine?
I mean, I feel I'm doing well as one can be. It's definitely a big adjustment, which is surprising because I generally work from home. I have a lot less work, as in almost none, which has not happened in my adult life before. And I'm trying to embrace it, reading, watching movies, going on walks when I can. I mean, Montreal is, we do have a lot of cases, but it's not because people aren't taking it seriously. It's just some poor decisions and bad luck. There's a lot of travel here, so that was probably the biggest contributor. But we're doing good. My family and loved ones are all well, so that's always great.
Yeah, that's always, always great. I check my privilege every day, but I am particularly checking my privilege right now about the fact that I'm in lockdown in New Zealand and we have quite extraordinary leadership around this to the point where yesterday's announcement was that we are currently infecting less than one person per New Zealander or something. I don't know how the stats work. Anyway, our curve is not just flat, it's going down below zero, which is, you know, there's a huge cost to that economically, of course, but it is such a good and privileged feeling to be governed well at this time. We are lucky. Well, that was really serious, but actually today on the Letterboxd Show, it's all about, we're going full horn. And Justine, it's all your fault. It was about a month ago, you made a list on Letterboxd called Best Horny Movies for Quarantine, an Erotic Film Canon, which now has well over 1,500 followers. Other Letterboxd members have been making comfort movie lists. You know, they've been watching Contagion and Outbreak, but no, here you are getting the horn on. What brought it on?
I mean, it's actually been a project I've been working on for years that I keep building on and then feeling as though I never have the right opportunity to kind of put it out there. I still would love to offer some writing contribution to it because I feel as though some of the choices are definitely raising eyebrows. I kind of chose a bit of an inflammatory title. It's less about horniness and more about erotica for me, which I think is an interesting distinction, but is less sexy. So I just thought, you know what, like people are at home, they want to watch movies. People are crazy thirsty on Twitter. Let's just go for it.
Kate, we wanted to get you in the mix of this one because you're no stranger to the power of erotic cinema. And, you know, you've got a few lists on your account, including essential erotic thrillers and a list for every day of the year, 365 sex scenes. I love that one. So good.
Just trying to bring the people what they want, which is sex and cinema. No, it's funny. Justine and I have known each other for several years on Twitter, and there is like a little contingent of particularly ladies on film Twitter who are like, you know, the five of us who are always like, no, this is horny and artful, though, guys. Because there is the sort of like, I don't know, there's a strain of film Twitter that's like, you know, the 17-year-olds who are in love with Timothy Chalamet, which is great. Good for them. Go down that road.
Which is fine. Yeah.
But it is. It does sort of feel like the level of up of like, oh, well, we're the old ones. We remember scrambled porn on Cinemax. Let us tell you about movies.
I mean, you know, yeah, exactly. When Emma with a period comes out and there's a couple of bare bottoms in the first 5 minutes and it gets everyone excited. It's like, oh, wait, but you haven't seen God's Own Country. You know, you want bare bottoms. You need to get a bit of Francis Lee on your screen. So we prepared earlier. We talked through what we all wanted to maybe rewatch or see for the first time. And we've got a few films to talk about, and I confess that I finally got around to watching Park Chan-wook's The Handmaiden, which is one of the highest rated films on Letterboxd, and you know, it's got a whopping 4.3 rating. It's number 45 on the official top 250 of all time. I don't know why I left it so long, but I dove in there. But we're also going to talk about a recent release by Jan Gonzalez called Knife and Heart. And we're going to dive deep, deep into Jane Campion's 2003 erotic thriller, In the Cut. Where do you want to start? What are you most excited about that you've seen in the last week?
Should we start with In the Cut, since it's the sort of oldest of those films we're talking about, and bring us to present? Is that a way of framing it?
Yep.
I think that's a great idea, except I'm just worried that we'll talk about it for so long we won't get to any of the other movies, but can we just agree that that's okay? I mean, I'm assuming we all loved it, but Justine, was it a first time watch for you?
No, I've seen it many times. I'm obsessed with the film. I think that it just got such a bad shake when it got released. And I'm so happy to see that so many people are now discovering it because it's available to stream. I read the book. I've seen the movie like 3 or 4 times, possibly more than any other Jane Campion movie, which I'm a huge fan. I don't say that lightly. I think it's sexy. I think it's dark. I love the cast. I love its mysterious early 2000s vibe. I just think it's fantastic.
I think it's important when we're talking about In the Cut to set the scene in terms of where Jane Campion was at, in terms of where Meg Ryan was at, in terms of where Mark Ruffalo was at. They're the two main actors in the film. So it's 2003, and at this point in Mark Ruffalo's career, he is in his mid-30s. He's appeared in a few things, but none really as a leading man, and certainly not a romantic comedy leading man. Those films, 13 Going on 30, Just Like Heaven, Rumor Has It, they came a few years after this. So this really is, for many of us, the first sort of time we got the full Mark Ruffalo thirst on, I guess. For me, it certainly was.
A very hot, sexy love affair that in the end changes them both, I think.
And how. He really gives us a lot to hold on to, literally and figuratively, in this moment.
I mean, the porn stash, for one, is just...
It's funny, I hadn't seen this since I was in high school, and at the time I was kind of like, well, that was fine, I didn't love it. But watching it again, it was really interesting just having, you know, 15 years more of watching movies under my belt and sort of understanding the female gaze and things like that. But I was really fixated on the fact that, like, this came at the end of the heyday of the erotic thriller, and I think kind of killed the genre for many years. I think, you know, what Justine was saying about, I definitely remember when this movie came out, it was like, oh, Meg Ryan's like dark new turn. But the reviews were so bad for this movie, just unfathomably bad.
Can I just read one sentence from one male reviewer at the time? Meg Ryan is desperately, unpersuasively naked in Jane Campion's ludicrous erotic thriller. And I'm just like, dude, seriously? So let's sort of clarify where Meg Ryan was at that point in time, because interestingly, this was supposed to be a Nicole Kidman vehicle. Jane Campion had directed Kidman in Portrait of a Lady. And Nicole Kidman is credited as a producer on the film. It was her first producing credit. She's since gone on to produce a lot more. So she was supposed to star in it, but it was, you know, also the time of her divorce from you-know-who. So Meg Ryan stepped up. At this point in Meg Ryan's career, she's America's, I wanted to say sweetheart, but Julia Roberts is also in the game, but she's sort of the kooky sweetheart. She spent her 30s starring in the biggest, most mainstream romantic knockouts, including When Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle, You've Got Mail. She's been a favorite of Nora Ephron and Diane Keaton. She's just starred opposite Hugh Jackman, bringing him into the rom-com world. She's just had that weird thing with Russell Crowe and around the time of Proof of Life. But it's been a couple of years since she's had a star vehicle, and she's now 42, so she's 6 years older than Mark Ruffalo. And it's a point of plot that he's a younger man and that she's a lecturer who's unmarried and hasn't had a child.
Nothing happens in that
book. To the lighthouse?
Yeah, one old lady dies.
How many ladies have to die to make it good?
At least three.
So it's an interesting time for her, and people really struggled with her taking on a role like Franny, didn't they? Well, men. Let's say men really struggled.
Yeah, I think it was this kind of perception that she would be young and innocent forever, because even though I love a lot of those rom-coms that she starred in, they are chaste even if they do deal with issues of sex. And this film is not only not chaste, it's so much about the erotic imagination of a woman that I think the majority of Hollywood producers didn't even want to acknowledge existed. And I think that there was so much of it, the way that there's so many of the reviews that I read from the time too were so cruel in terms of the way they described her physically, the way that they described the, like you kind of infer the nature of having a lecturer who's unmarried. There are these like undercurrents that really pin this like really awful misogyny that just is honestly just horrifying.
Yeah, it's sort of like, did they see the same film we saw? Because I remember the first time I saw it thinking, porn aside, thinking, I think this is the first depiction of a man going down on a woman I've seen in a so-called mainstream film in my life that I've seen. And for me, that was like a major turning point in terms of seeing women's pleasure depicted on screen, specifically seeing women being pleasured.
Hey, listen, I could be whatever you want me to be. Now you want me to romance you, take you to a classy restaurant, no problem. You want me to be your best friend and fuck you, treat you good, lick your pussy, no problem.
And in that sort of first amazing, beautiful sex scene between Mark Ruffalo and Meg Ryan's characters, it begins with her just looking at him, and with one word she just says, all right. And she's given her consent, you know, and it's sort of, that's what I noticed with this latest watch. I'd completely forgotten that, but the consent is explicit. And then so is the sex. It's awesome. It's awesome.
It's really striking to see a sex scene in a movie like this when you realize this is, you know, 17 years ago. And then trying to think of an equivalent of a Meg Ryan and a Mark Ruffalo doing a sex scene like that in a movie today, it wouldn't happen. Like, it just wouldn't exist. We don't do sex scenes like that anymore. Like, they happen in international films. Once every like 5 or 10 years, you'll get something that sort of breaks out. But huge movie stars doing a sex scene this explicit, we've totally turned away from that. And I think it's a great point about a lot of those rom-coms, which are wonderful but are very chaste. And so I'm sure my grandmother loved Meg Ryan. I'm sure had she watched In the Cut, she would have been horrified. But I think too, like, I don't know, I was thinking a lot about how this movie is sort of the answer to all of that, like, sort of slick, smooth jazz, like glass bricks, erotic thrillers. This movie is the total opposite of that. I also had not really considered like this sort of post 9/11-ness of it and being in a New York that's really fractured and nobody is happy and nobody is having a good time and everything is really unstable. And placing the story in that context really, I don't know, I felt like I was able to tap into Franny's emotional life in a way that I really wasn't able to when I watched it when I was a teenager. But I don't know if there is enough hyperbole for the sex scene in this movie. It's one of the best sex scenes in movies. Mark Ruffalo, guys, American hero.
My other favorite thing about him is he asks her if it's all right for him to smoke in her apartment. And she says no. And he puts the cigarette out. It's like, come on, guys, it's that simple. Justine, you've read the book, and I really want to preserve anyone who's listening. I want to preserve their first time, as it were, seeing this movie. So it's sort of without spoiling the way the book ends and the way the film ends. are different. And Susanna Moore, the novelist, worked on the script with Jane Campion, and they made a really powerful decision, which plays, you know, all the way back into all of the ideas about, you know, Meg Ryan and consent and control and power and exploration. I just wondered if you had the ability, without spoiling anything, to talk a bit about that.
I think I can. I think that they're drastically different. I mean, if you read, I was shocked when I read the book because I had read it after I watched the movie. I think, though, what they're kind of leaning into is this history of erotic fiction in terms of the adaptation that is so focused on the imagination. I find it interesting that I find the movie is actually more caught up in perception and in terms of this kind of internal imagined erotic world than the novel, which does lean into some more explicit territory in terms of this is what is happening in an objective reality, where Jane Campion, and in particular this ending that they adapt, is so removed from concrete world and is so focused on perception. And again, this kind of goes back to, I think, why the film is so exciting and so different than so many others, that you're really in this consciousness of this woman who has this fantastic imagination, but is also caught in the darkness of a very scary, unstable real world.
I mean, we should jump in here for anyone who's never seen the film and explain that at its heart, the film is about there's a murder investigation going on in New York City alongside Meg Ryan, just trying to live her life without her, you know, students and her stalker, Kevin Bacon, who I always forget is in this movie until Kevin Bacon turns up.
I had 100% forgotten that. And I was like, is that Kevin Bacon?
And it takes you a few scenes, right? Because he's sort of, you know, he's at a distance. She sees him out the window, you know, it's interesting. Anyway, a body has been found in the garden underneath Meg Ryan's apartment window. And so one of the investigating cops comes to ask her some questions, and that's Mark Ruffalo. So the first time they meet is at her apartment door, you know, up the stairwell in a New York apartment building, which is intimacy in itself. So that's sort of where it all starts, you know. And the filming style is so invested in Meg Ryan's internality, as you say. You know, there's a scene where really early on she's being driven in the detective's car downtown. Mark Ruffalo and his detective partner have got some photos to show her because they want to see if she can identify, or if she's seen the woman before, if the woman in the photo is, you know, someone she might have seen in a bar. And the photo they give her is the photo of this woman's dismembered head. She is sitting in the back seat, and the camera is filming backwards. So we sort of see Mark Ruffalo, we sort of see his partner, but we're looking at her being given this incredibly distressing image and then watching her understand and get to grips with the situation she's in, which is not just that she needs to identify this woman, but that she's in the backseat of a cop car, that they've just thrust this picture in front of her without getting her consent to look at it. You know, that, yeah, all, it's all, I just love the angles in this. The angles just speak so perfectly to the themes and to the character of Franny.
I feel like Campion is such a master of visual information and never gets enough credit for, I don't know. I feel like when people talk about her films, a lot of times they talk about the sort of emotional response, which is incredible. But I don't think she gets enough credit for being just like one of our great visualists. And there are so many details in this movie where she just completely fills the frame. And I think too, that sort of, you know, coming to terms with the fact that we're seeing Franny's subjective reality, and, you know, there are some moments when there is like lens flare and blur around the edges. It's like, as a first time viewer, I found that a little bit alienating, but then watching it again, when you sort of settle into the rhythm of the movie, you're like, oh, now I understand why we're doing this. Now I understand that I'm not supposed to be having a good time in these early scenes. Like, I'm supposed to feel as disoriented as she does. And then as the film goes on, the visual language sort of smooths itself out as, you know, ironically, the plot becomes twistier and scarier. But as Franny starts taking control of her life. I feel like the visual language does a really good job of matching that. And man, Campion, it's infuriating the way female filmmakers are not talked about as masters the way that male filmmakers are. But she, to me, is one of the greatest examples of somebody who should be vaunted and celebrated like a John Ford or a Steven Spielberg, and just hasn't been. And it's ridiculous. That's my Jane Campion rant. The end.
What I was going to just add is that part of what makes her such a great filmmaker, which I think informs the visual style, is she is underrated. I think in general, we don't talk enough about framing and blocking. And the way that she positions the characters within the frame, the way that she positions the camera in relation to them, kind of what you were talking about, Gemma, and the car, kind of breaks conventions in a way that underlines different power dynamics and also shifting power. And like, I think that for me, that's one of the greatest appeals of her work, is I'm really fascinated by how relationships and power kind of have these, like, within the same conversation, sometimes within the same sentence, within the same scene, you can have the power drift from one person to another. And I don't know if there is a greater filmmaker at capturing that than Jane Campion. And she's using all kinds of tricks. She's obviously working with incredibly talented actors, but the way she puts them in the rooms, the way she puts them in relation to each other, it has such a huge psychological impact that just, like, especially in this film, I feel so powerful.
And the way she lifts very few details off a script and infuses an entire scene with almost wordless understanding. I can't stop thinking about the scene. So Meg Ryan is at one point, still early on in the film, attacked at random in an alleyway. And then she also has sex for the first time with Mark Ruffalo, which is amazing and should just be watched again and again. And then she goes to meet her sister, Jennifer Jason Leigh, for coffee. And at that moment, only then does she reveal any trauma from the attack in the alleyway. And she just does it through tears, and her sister understands. Her sister gets it. But in the same sentence kind of goes, you need to see that detective again. I know you want to. You need to see him again. And it's just this beautiful scene between, two women, friends, half-sisters, whatever, who totally get that it's okay to hold both of those things to be true at the same time. You are traumatized and you need more sex with Mark Ruffalo.
I feel like when we do get things like desire and sex scenes in movies now, it's always very sort of, at least in mainstream studio movies, it's very sort of, okay, here's a man and a woman and now they're going to have sex under the covers and that's that. But seeing a movie like this really makes you realize that there are just entire languages around desire and sex and lust that we have yet to explore in movies. And the fact that, desire is often problematic. There are kink and fetish things that people have that if you said them aloud, it would be like, what is wrong with you? But, all of these things are valid. People's desires are valid. And realizing that two things can exist at once and be a little bit messy and get into the nitty gritty of what that means. It's just really nice to watch a film like this that really understands that, these things are not often wrapped up in neat little boxes and the hero doesn't get the heroine and they have sex once and then have a baby and that's it.
One thing I'm finding is that as we move more towards having intimacy coordinators on set for intimate scenes in movies, you can go back and watch a film from, only 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And for the most part, the whole film holds together, but in the sex scenes, it kind of, in the current context, it feels a bit skeevy. It falls down. It really doesn't feel like there was an intimacy coordinator on set. I didn't feel that within the cut. I feel like there was an inherent understanding between the entire cast and crew in that room at that time of what was going on. And it's just something I love about it. Another thing I love about In the Cut. And then it's also this, the other thing, when you have these conventional kind of sex scenes that a straight couple moves towards, there's that classic, the L-shaped sheet. You know what I'm talking about? The post-coital scene with the sheet that comes up over her boobies and, him at the waist. None of that in the Cut. And also, as I was watching Frances Lee's God's Own Country this week, there was a great post-coital scene where, because it's England on a farm and it's fucking freezing, they're sitting there bottomless but with these really lovely warm jerseys on over the top, just kind of lazing around having a post-coital chat.
In my country, spring is the most beautiful. The sun, the flowers, the smells.
And I just love that. I just love any post-coital scene that removes the L-shaped sheet and shows us what really happens after a couple of people bang.
Yeah, without having that kind of awkward transition, I feel that this movie, it finds a way to kind of create a bridge between these different emotional states of intimacy, because there's an intimacy of sex, but then there's also the intimacy of post-sex, which many filmmakers decline to address in any realistic way. Kind of, I love, like, I've never heard the term L-shaped sheet, but the second you said it, I'm like, I knew exactly what you meant. And it's such a bizarre, artificial cliche.
I think Campion is really good at the casual full frontal male shot, which is something that nobody else has really done. For some reason, my brain had remembered that there was like a very sort of clear dead-on shot of Mark Ruffalo naked in this, when that's not the case at all. It's all of these sort of obscured lighting and shadow moments, and that's the case in Sweetie, obviously less so in The Piano. It's a little more upfront, but it's really surprising to see that and then remember that, like, oh yeah, we could be doing that all the time, and we could treat male nudity as just as casual as we often treat female nudity, and nobody ever wants to do it. So it's really nice to see a filmmaker who fully embraces that.
I mean, the thing about In the Cut is that it's still sitting on other film aggregation platforms at around about 33% approval rating, which in 2020 seems, you know, given what we now know about the female gaze, seems a bit rough. So I've been sort of unofficially tracking its rating on Letterboxd over the years, and I looked again today and it's at a 3.2, which is a good 64-65%. Like, we're getting into the top third of approval here. So I got one of the chaps at HQ to run the numbers, and when Letterboxd was first founded, Jane Campion's In the Cut was running at about a 2-point average. And so over the last 9 years, as more people come to appreciate this absolute Campion genius, and maybe, I don't know, maybe because Mark Ruffalo is now a Marvel superhero or whatever it is, we are at 3.2. And that's a rise of well over one whole Letterboxd point in a short space of time. And I just want to say, Letterboxd knows where the Jane Campion thirst is at. We're going to take a quick intermission now and hear from some Letterboxd members out there in the world who have left us some voice messages to tell us the horny, erotic films that they have been enjoying in quarantine.
Hello, this is TerrorZex. My erotic thriller, which I'm putting forward, is The Handmaiden. I think it's quite thrilling. It's also quite sexy in rare places, for obvious reasons. It ends up making you root for the girls and making you not root for boys. But I enjoy it very much, and it's going straight on my erotic thrillers list when I start making the list. Thank you.
Hey, my name is Alicia, and my Letterboxd username is Alicia MMMMMM with 6 M's. Right before coronavirus, I started seeing someone, and we're also both fourth-year medical students about to start residency in 2 months, so this time has been especially challenging. So I decided to watch Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love for the first time. It captured so much of what I'm feeling right now. It's one of the most stunning movies I've ever seen, and I can't recommend it enough.
You're listening to The Letterboxd Show. I'm Gemma Gracewood, and also with me are Kate Hagen in LA and Justine Smith in Montreal. We are talking about horny cinema this week. So from Jane Campion's In the Cut, which was itself adapted from a novel by Susanna Moore, we're moving on to another adaptation, The Handmaiden, which was adapted from the novel Fingersmith by the Welsh novelist Sarah Waters and came out in 2016. And is directed by Park Chan-wook. And just a few Letterboxd stats for you. This film is an absolute stonker. It sits at number 45 on the official Letterboxd top 250 of all time. In the decade of the 2010s, it was the sixth highest rated film overall. It was the third highest rated romance. Portrait of a Lady on Fire won that one. And the third highest rated international film, Parasite, was number one, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, number two. It's huge. And I watched it for the first time this week, but how many times have you seen it, Justine?
I've seen it only once, and it was when it played at a festival, so I haven't seen it since it came out. but it had such a huge impact. And I even remember, like, it was the last film I had seen at a local film festival called Festival du Nouveau Cinéma. And I almost didn't get in. It was pouring rain in October, so it was freezing. And I was at that point where you're like full festival fatigue. You're like, I don't know if I could handle one more movie. And I'm waiting out in the freezing rain, and I'm like almost going to like turn around and go home. And I'm like, I'm just going to stay. I'm going to like cross my fingers. And I'm so happy I did. It was such an incredible experience. For people who haven't seen it and love Parasite, it has a lot of the same twists and turns, but with a great erotic element.
Yeah, I've only seen this one once too, but it's similar to Justine, had a huge impact. It was one of those things that had been recommended to me, and I really like Park Chan-wook. But seeing it, I feel like I still wasn't fully prepared for how much I was going to love it. This is the kind of movie that I pitch to people as like, it literally has everything I love in movies in it. You know, some really complex, interesting female leads. It's really sexy. It's very twisty. It's never one thing at once. There are moments where you go from laughing super hard to, you know, recoiling in horror. I don't know. This to me is like a full meal of a movie in a way that very few American films feel like to me anymore, in terms of just being a feast for all the senses.
I am so glad I somehow managed to know nothing about it, and specifically about its structure, which I think is important. If you're listening and you haven't seen The Handmaiden yet, and you're thinking about giving it a go, just don't read anything about the structure. It's definitely one of those ones like Parasite, where, you know, everyone says, don't know anything about it before you go in, blah, 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 blah. And you kind of think, oh, well, what can it hurt to read a couple of reviews? Just go with it. And like you say, it's the complete bag, not only in terms of all the twists and turns in the plot and the fact that it is funny and it is dramatic, but to look at, just to look at. I could look at The Handmaiden all day long. It is one of the most sumptuous films, I think, that's ever been made. Yeah, I'm sort of obsessed with when we can start flying again, obsessed with going to Japan to the house where most of the film takes place, because it really is this weird, wonderful combination of Victorian mansion and traditional Japanese house. It's so cool. I have to admit, I struggle with films, and, you know, having just talked about In the Cut, which is an erotic thriller where there is some blood and gore alongside really hot sex, I struggle with films where there is loving sex and then there is some really, really dark shit going on. I struggle with it and sort of almost want to turn away. And luckily the strength of the plot held me and the strength of the central triangle held me. But I have to admit I do struggle. And I know it's the point. I know it's the point of these stories, but I find it really, my eyeballs, my cognitive senses really struggle with that combination of deep, dark violence, which I know is part of the whole thing. But I also feel like it's okay to say that I struggle with it, and especially because I didn't know anything about The Handmaiden going in and I haven't read the novel, I was surprised with where it went in parts, and I'm not sure my brain was ready for that. And that might also be part and parcel of the times we're in, that kind of feeling of already being suffocating in quarantine and then suddenly someone's putting images on a screen that you don't necessarily want to take to sleep with you. But that's, yeah, I would say if there was a thing that keeps me from giving it the full 5 stars, it would be that, and it would be maybe the depiction of the sex between the two main characters. I feel like we're in bluest, the warmest colored territory versus Portrait of a Lady on Fire in the cut territory.
I would actually love to hear y'all's take on that, because this is a question about the movie that's come up for me in conversation since I've seen it. You are definitely not the first person, the first woman I've heard say that they find the sex scenes a little bit porny in The Handmaiden. And that was not my take when I saw it, but I can see where somebody would sort of, I don't know, I think the moment with the bells is a lot. That's a lot to sort of wrap your brain around. You'll know when you see the movie if what we're talking about, but I'm not going to spoil it here. But it's, I'm glad you brought that up because it's an interesting point about this one in particular that I feel like has come up multiple times. But I don't know that I have a good answer for it personally.
I mean, I think that fundamentally it's so hyper stylized, and part of that stylized nature is the explicit beauty of the two women that seems to be kind of catered, it is catered very much towards a very traditional gaze of the female body. I do kind of take it as part of the whole film's over-stylized nature, and so it didn't bother me that much, but there was still kind of an undercurrent for me that there was a discomfort. I don't know if I want to say it was a discomfort, but there was an awareness that this is not reality. And in that sense, I think that it's one of the better examples, but compared to something like what we just talked about in The Cut, which is so informed by the reality of sex, this I would say is not. It is a hyper stylized, opulent fantasy, and I think we can argue endlessly over whose fantasy it really is.
Yeah, I definitely hear you on that, and I would agree there is a deliberate element of highly choreographed action, both in the sex scenes and in the violence scenes, and both sex and violence are so central to the telling of the story from all the different perspectives that, you know, yep, I'm prepared to take that on board. I'm good. I don't know. I think maybe if you're in quarantine and you're starting to watch it at 1 a.m. like I did because you can't sleep, maybe pick another time of day. I don't know. Maybe first thing when you wake up. I don't know. But it is, yeah, it is certainly a thing of beauty and not the kind of film that gets made in the West. It's really not.
I don't know. A movie like this makes me think about how integral sex scenes can be to a plot and how you can kind of shape a plot around sex scenes and how few people choose to do that anymore. Like, I don't know. I feel like the classic sort of pitch on that is Roger Ebert talking about how Cronenberg's Crash is structured like a porno and that, like, once everyone has slept together, then the movie is over. But I really feel like filmmakers don't really embrace the sort of narrative potential of sex scenes in a way that they could be. I don't know. I feel like The Handmaiden, you do reveal a lot about character through the scenes in it. And regardless of Park Chan-wook's male gaze or sort of this overarching sort of male fantasy that these sex scenes might fit into, I do think it's interesting to think about how they can reveal character, reveal plot, and, you know, delve into some bigger truths about the film.
I think, too, what's so interesting right now about South Korean cinema, I think exposes kind of the problem that Western cinema, in particular Hollywood, is kind of looking into, is the fact that it doesn't fit easily into any kind of genre. And I think that sex scenes and romance in general, the way that it has been treated in the past, I would say 15, 20 years, let's say, in American film, is that a movie has to be one thing. If they can't market it as a comedy, if they can't market it as a romance, they almost don't know how to do anything. And so I think sex scenes, which I think, Kate, you've done like the studies on it, there's less and less in American film. And I think part of it is connected not necessarily with an increased prudishness, although I do think that there's elements of like some weird perceptions of sex. I think a lot of it also has to do with the way that movies are made. They're made by algorithms, not necessarily in like a robot is writing them, but they're so informed by data that they're like, we don't know what to do with a sex scene. You can't sell a movie that's rated R. So in South Korea in particular, where you have movies like The Handmaiden or Parasite, which don't easily fit into one single genre either, you're seeing kind of a liberation of narrative that is almost dying out in American cinema.
So given that, and before we move on to another film, what are some of your favorite sex scenes in cinema in terms of the way that they serve the narrative?
I mean, the first one that comes to me is Don't Look Now. I know it's a classic. Everyone always talks about it. But you're talking about a sex scene that is so beautifully choreographed, so iconoclastic in terms of the editing style, and reveals so much about character and place, where you have this opening sequence with this traumatic event, and then you have time that passes and this reunion of a married couple that probably hasn't been intimate for a very long time. And there's this kind of counterbalance of wordlessly you understand all of that, as well as this kind of balance between they're used to each other, they know each other, they know how to pleasure each other and make themselves feel good, but they're also in new territory where they haven't touched each other in a long time and their minds are maybe elsewhere and they're using sex in a way to forget all of that. But at the end of the day, you can't. I think it's just like, that is like the masterclass. I think it's heralded for a reason. It's just so good. And it's again, I think if that movie were made today, that sex scene would not be there.
It would be like, well, we kissed and now we cut to some blankets and that's all it was.
I mean, you know, we sort of know what it's about, but what is it about? You know, we do have this sort of wonderful, in the last 10, 20 years, we've got new independent studios coming up, bringing out really interesting new genre films where, you know, a former twinkly vampire like Robert Pattinson can just go at it, masturbating for a good few minutes in The Lighthouse. But why are we not getting the Ruffalo action in 2020? What's going on in Western movies?
It was interesting. When I wrote the piece for Playboy, I was really surprised by one particular strain of the response, and that was people in their early 20s or late teens talking about all sex scenes are gross. I hate seeing sex scenes. I'm repulsed by them. I never want to see actors do that. And that was so disappointing to me because, I don't know, I think it just sort of spoke to a sort of larger fear I have about Generation Z and how they view intimacy and the messiness of love and relationships and figuring all that out, that, you know, sex scenes cannot be sort of easily compartmentalized in the way that other things can in a movie. And so when they have grown up on, you know, movies without very many sex scenes and content like YouTube that isn't very sexy most of the time, that there are a lot of younger folks' reaction is a sort of knee jerk, like, that's gross, I don't like that. I don't know. It's just really interesting to me that that was a lot of the younger take on the conversation, and disappointing. I don't know. I mean, a lot of the great movies I saw as a young person, I saw because of the sex in them, and I was watching because I was like, you know, I mean, my story, I've told this story before, but like, I was 12 years old and I knew Crash was supposed to be very horny, Cronenberg's Crash. And I was like, it's on cable. I'm going to watch this. What's the worst that can happen? And that movie broke my brain. It absolutely broke my brain. I saw like the opening sequence with James Spader and the camera girl, and then I couldn't see the rest of the movie for 6 months. I like literally got called to dinner. But just like sitting with that in my brain for 6 months, I was like, what did I just see with the guy from Pretty in Pink? Like, what? I don't know. It just speaks to I hope that they are becoming curious viewers in other ways, because there was something when I was a kid about, you know, seeking out illicit stuff and the late night movie on HBO, and this has a strong sexual content warning, so I'm going to watch it. But I would say, you know, I feel like one of the easy scapegoats is like, oh, well, everybody just watches porn all the time now. And that's true up to a certain extent, but I think it's a lot more complicated than that. And I think that's only one facet of sort of what shaped our desires. But I don't know. I want the youth to embrace sex in movies. I hope that they realize that sexy movies can be really cool and fun and a great time, and you can even learn something about yourself.
Like, there's a gap that needs to be bridged between increasingly prim mainstream films and the extremely accessible, readily available porn that the kids are watching today and learning from. And, you know, but there are films that are filling that gap in ways. Call Me by Your Name, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, you know, that it is there. It's just not necessarily there in, I guess, mainstream American cinema in the same way that ridiculous and frankly insulting stuff around sex was around, you know, when I was watching the movies I was watching as a teen, like 16 Candles and Revenge of the Nerds. I mean, that stuff, in hindsight, was rape porn. And we didn't know it then because we just kind of, you know, it was it's what dudes do in the 80s.
Make a deal with you. Let me keep these. I'll let you take Carolyn home. But you gotta make sure she gets home. You can't leave her in some parking lot somewhere. okay?
Jake, I'm only a freshman.
So? She's so blitz, she won't know the difference.
You know, so that's, and in a way, let's talk about Jane Campion again for a minute. That's why come 2003 and the cut was such a revelation, because it was hot sex, hot consensual sex, you know, in a film that was about something else as well. I feel like filmmakers are going there, just not necessarily in the West. You know, Call Me By Your Name may have had an American cast, but, you know, that is an Italian sensibility at work there with Luca Guadagnino.
I feel like we sort of come full circle with the, like, you know, late 60s art house. Ooh, like the European movies. We're back to that point where, like, you go to international films for good sex scenes.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, I was just trying to think of what are some of the more recent films that have, an American film, that have great sex. It's hard. There's definitely sexy movies, but...
I don't know. The only sort of example I can come up with on a regular basis is the sex scene in Inherent Vice, in terms of being a complicated, thorny, sexy scene between two big actors in a big American studio movie. But what, that's 4 or 5 years ago at this point, and there's only one PTA. Only one person gets to do that.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting, like, the English language films that I'm looking at that are not even American, they tend to almost exclusively come from auteurs who have a lot of different permissiveness in terms of funding, in terms of choices, and in terms of power. Like, David Cronenberg consistently is pretty much a god on that front, you know? Like, he can do whatever he wants. I mean, I am looking at Deep Blue Sea, that's Terrence Davies, and again, another auteur, and you have to go back pretty far to get just some for-hire director or like even a respected independent filmmaker who's going to treat sex at all. It's crazy.
Yeah, bring on the next Jane Campion, and literally the next Jane Campion movie, which is maybe almost finished filming in New Zealand before the lockdown. They've maybe got a couple of weeks to go, no?
Oh, I was just crossing my fingers because I want it to be real.
I want it to be so good. Benedict Cumberbatch. Oh, my God. Hey, let's hear from some more Letterboxd members out there in the world about what they've been watching lately and enjoying in the comfort of their quarantine.
Hello. I just watched Rocky Horror Picture Show for the first time in my entire life, and I don't know what to make of it, except that I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was weird, and Tim Curry was really good, but also I don't know what happened, but also it was really good, but also I don't get it. So that's my thoughts on Rocky Horror. Cheers.
Hello, I'm Daniel, and I would just like to say that Dr. Sleep was really dang good for this past year. I think it's my favorite movie of the year. Well, I'll see you guys next time.
You are back with the Letterboxd Show. I'm Gemma Gracewood in Auckland, New Zealand. And with me are Kate Hagen in LA and Justine Smith in Montreal. We are talking about cinema erotica, horny thrillers that we've been watching lately. And there's one that came out in 2018 by Jan Gonzalez, starring Vanessa Paradis. And it's called Knife and Heart. And it was on my festival list when it came out and I missed it. So I'm really glad you brought it up because I finally got around to watching it this weekend. And what a ride.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like I really liked it, but I don't feel like I have 100% of my full opinion on it yet. But I don't know, something curious that came to mind when watching that was similarly with Portrait of a Lady on Fire and The Handmaiden. Many of the good sex scenes we're talking about from the last couple of years have not been straight sex scenes. They've been LGBTQ+ sex scenes. And that's really cool. That's something to get excited about. The fact that, like, we're finally seeing accurate representation. Well, accurate, maybe not in Knife and Heart since we're dealing with pornography sets, but more real depictions of what queer sex looks like in a way that we haven't really had in film before. Knife and Heart is a really fun time, though. It's, you know, movies like this that are clearly sort of homaging not only a particular filmmaker, but a style of filmmaking and a genre can be extremely hit or miss for me. But this had way more hits than misses. And, you know, it's just a really immersive viewing experience. The score from M83 really takes you to that sort of De Palma, Pino Donato territory. And it's, as you were saying, Gemma, it's just such a visual feast. It's hard to at least not be be really respectful of what they were trying to achieve in terms of the visual sense of the movie.
Yeah, it's quite a fascinating plot. Again, like in the cut, there's two stories going on. There's a love story involving Vanessa Paradis, who's a producer of porn films in the late 70s, and her editor, who they've had an on-again, off-again, deep abiding love for each other. Meanwhile, she's producing these great, hot, gay porn films, but there is a serial killer out there who is picking off her actors one by one. And she sort of didn't see this at first, but I love the twist where she becomes the investigator, basically. And it's so cool. It's so weird and wonderful how it weaves all of the different plot points together and also just takes the time to spend a good 10 minutes filming in a dance club while Vanessa's character watches her former lover get it on the dance floor with a new girl. Which is seemingly extra to the main plot, but of course is inherently connected. I just love that. I just love that it took time to immerse us in some pretty awesome scenes.
Yeah, what I loved about this movie was that it's so much about these layers of artifice. We've seen so many homages to this genre of cinema, to Italian giallo and to early 80s American erotic thrillers. And so many of them are superficial. And I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, because I love a lot of these movies, like Hélène Catet and Bruno Forzani, like Amère and those. I think they're beautiful. But this movie, it brings that extra layer of performance, of metatextuality, which has to do with the way we interact with the world we are in, and the queer subtext here as well, of the performance of sexuality, the performance of identity, the performance of sex in front of the camera, behind the camera, in imagination, in fantasy, and how all of these lines are completely blurred. I mean, I feel, just as both of you have said, I watched this afternoon and I'm like, I need more time. I need more time to process it all, because it's so much in such a fabulous sense of the word, just because it's so unusual to see a movie that just like marries this strange, over the top, artificial, insane excessiveness with theme, with story, with character in a way that makes absolute emotional, psychological sense.
Speaking of so much, I mean, we do need to say that the first 10 minutes are a lot. You know, depending on what time of day you're settling in to watch it, it's like, oh, okay. You know, again, as with The Handmaiden, and possibly more with this one, I really struggled with those first 10 minutes and thought, am I going to last the distance? Because this is, you know, there's the setup of the world going on and there is the first murder, as we know it, taking place. And it is, it's intense, right? It's intense. You know, I understand that writers and directors are constantly looking for new ways to kill people in movies to, you know, keep pushing genre forward. But this was a next level, right?
This is a couple that are really like, wow, we're going there. Okay. I was like, there's no way this movie got rated. I watched it on Shudder, which shout out to Shudder for having like a very queer, very explicit horror film on the service that is, you know, traditionally serving a horror audience that doesn't necessarily want those things, but it's really nice that they're like, this is great and you should watch it. Because it does, I feel like it goes to some places that we're not seeing in not just American movies, but just movies generally. But I like that it confronted the viewer. I really responded to taking the sort of, you know, put upon male character whose life is sort of a mess and he's got romantic entanglements. And I loved flipping that script and making it Vanessa Paradis. And I love that the movie really pushes us to be on board with everything that she does. There's one scene in particular where she does something that's quite frankly unforgivable, but the movie kind of asks you to go with it and sort of sit with your discomfort around this thing that she's done as we're watching her solve this case and want to get this murder and be righteous in that quest. So I appreciate it that there, you know, as Justine was saying, there's a lot of emotional complexity going on, especially in a genre, I don't know, we've all seen Michael Douglas, the investigator, in a number of erotic thrillers. It was nice to see that sort of archetype flipped here. And Vanessa Paradis, I thought, was really fantastic in the movie, too. I really loved her performance.
Yeah, same. And I really feel like we could do with a series, right? We could do with a series with a woman in that kind of role who we get to see being complex and messy and solve mystery murders. It's great. We need more of it. You know, we had it in television a lot. Television is a really safe place, especially British television and Scandinavian television, to have a woman solving crime and be complex. We need more of that on the big screen. That's, you know, that is definitely one of the aspects of it that I loved. And, you know, for all that we sit around talking about strong female characters, blah, 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 that's what we're talking about. Messy female characters, you know, bring on the messy female characters, not the strong female characters. The really fucked up, really messy ones.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and it takes a lot to be as permissibly messy as this in terms of kind of playing with star personas. Obviously, like Vanessa Paradis is a huge star in France. She's a relatively large star elsewhere. And I think that this really plays on the fact that she's kind of like in the way that Celine Dion is, but a bit more French.
There's like a reference.
She's a gay icon. And kind of toying with that perception and toying with the fact that she's a mega star, a mega performer who sings a lot of really cheesy songs, and have her play something so gritty and dirty. And she's so petite. She's like the smallest person I've ever seen on a screen almost. And kind of toying with those perceptions as well, and just appreciating her for who she is and letting her do everything. And props to her, because I don't know how many actors, even really, really accomplished ones, not saying that she isn't, but she doesn't have the filmography that some other female actresses may have, just going for it. You never feel like she's holding back at any moment in this movie.
And one other thing that needs to be said about Knife and Heart is that if you are a cinephile, this definitely falls into that category of movies that are about movie making, where you get lots of great scenes in cinemas and great scenes on set, and each member of the crew is a distinct character in and of themselves. And there's a lot of humor in that. You know, as much as we're talking about an erotic thriller, there's a lot of humor on set, which I really appreciated.
I think to Justine's earlier point about at some point American movies decided they could only be one thing, and that's just sort of the ethos we went forward with. I think that's what people forget about a lot of these movies. Like, there's some laughs in Basic Instinct. Like, a lot of these sexy movies had great levity because you have to break up that tension. It can't just be 90 minutes of sexual tension or sexual relief. Like, that's a different kind of movie, which is fine. But I don't understand why people can't, you know, wrap their brains around the fact that you can be laughing one minute and crying the next and really aroused the next minute. So it was really nice to see there's a great character in Knife and Heart called the Golden Mouth that you will learn more about. But just those little touches of like, we're in this super dark territory, but it doesn't have to be oppressive and it doesn't have to make you feel bad. It was a really nice change of pace in that way.
It was so beautiful. So beautiful. It was like Kevin Bacon popping up and in the cut. Just got that great level of hilarity. Well, that about wraps up our horny cinema update for this week's podcast. But Kate, I wanted to hear from you. One or two or 300 of your favorite sex scenes, especially as they relate to narrative in cinema.
I already went long on Cronenberg's Crash, which is to me like the sex movie of all time. It's perfect. I saw it last year at the New Beverly on a 35 millimeter print, and there were a couple of shots that I had never seen, which was cool. But I don't know, everything you learn about the characters in Crash, you learn through the sex that they have with each other. And I think that's really fascinating. And it's a bummer to me that more filmmakers don't sort of want to get into that territory.
One of the early cards that someone filled out at one of the screenings that I had said, you know, a series of sex scenes is not a plot. And I kind of laughed to myself and said, well, why not? Why is a series of sex scenes not possibly a plot? It can be. And in fact, in the book it is, and in the movie it is as well.
But I would say the other two in my sort of holy trinity are Damage, a movie that I think also really gets into that sort of gray area of, you know, at some point we're all going to have a desire in our lives that is all consuming. But the question is, what do you do with that all consuming desire? And the sex scenes between Jeremy Irons and Juliette Binoche in that movie are so harrowing and make you feel every way at once. You're turned on and you're troubled and you're depressed and you're elated. And it's just it's a really revelatory movie in terms of how it deals with sex shaping who the characters are. And then the other one is a little more fun. You know, the Wachowskis' Bound, which is just fantastic.
Yes.
It's a great ride. It's such a fun riff on noir, on erotic thrillers, on, you know, what the conventions of those genres are. And I love that they brought on Susie Bright to advise on the sex scene between Gina Gershon and Jennifer Tilly. You can really tell it's really lived in. Similarly, like, it's a little bit playful and it's a little bit sad, but it's sexy. And I don't know. Those to me are kind of, if you wanted a primer on sex in cinema, those would be the three movies I would tell folks to watch.
Well, flipping the switch completely, we like to do a couple of things towards the end of the podcast to reflect the current times, which is not to say you can't keep talking about sex. I mean, let's go there. But I wanted to hear from you what your quarantine pick-me-up recommendations would be for people listening right now. What's something that's bringing a bit of levity in the cinematic scene to you right now?
For me, I'm finding myself being really drawn to old favorites. I think that there is a lot, like, there's finally time to just go back and rediscover a movie that you loved. And for me, I'm obsessed with Marilyn Monroe, and I'm watching movies like Gentlemen for Blondes, How to Marry a Millionaire, Some Like It Hot, which are just so fantastic. And they make me laugh. They are so clever, so beautiful. They're so wonderful. I can't imagine watching, I'm recommending like explicitly Gentlemen for Blondes. I can't imagine watching that movie and not having such a great escapist, silly time.
Kate?
Yeah, it's funny. My attention span with movies is either all or nothing. Like, I will not watch a movie for 2 weeks. And then yesterday I watched three movies. So it's been a little wonky compared to my normal viewing. One thing I rewatched that was definitely a comfort viewing was Francis Ford Coppola's Peggy Sue Got Married, which I actually think is a great movie to watch right now. Because it's, I don't know, I had seen it before, but it had been a while. And I was just so struck by what a beautiful movie it is about living in the present. And, you know, knowing what was going on with Coppola at the time and kind of his personal life and the grief he was dealing with. I just think it's a really beautiful movie about appreciating the people you're with and the moments that you're with them. Like, there's that gorgeous sequence when she realizes she can go see her grandparents again, and they're sort of in on it. But it was just really striking to me watching it again, what a great movie it is about time and, you know, distance and the sort of ways in which we insulate ourselves that we don't need to insulate ourselves. So that's definitely been a comfort rewatch that I've been thinking about a lot since I checked it out again.
I need to put all of those on my list. I have a 4-year-old, and so a lot of my comfort watching happens during the day with him. And I guess I wouldn't, you know, if I was describing my cinematic tastes, I wouldn't call myself someone who loves animation in particular or Pixar in particular, but it turns out that one of my all-time favorite movies is Ratatouille. And every time I watch it, I am as happy as the first time I ever saw a film about rats in the kitchen. Let's talk now about who out there in the film world has been bringing you joy in terms of what they've been choosing to do with their social media in lockdown or otherwise.
I'm going for someone who I think is just killing it. Kay Austin Collins for Vanity Fair is doing the Shut-In Movie Club. So far he's written about The Thing and Safe. And I think that as most of our movie choices for how did you kind of deal with the quarantine is like, let's go back to what comforts us. He's kind of doing that in a way that's actually confronting the moment that I find is so smart. He's like, I'm obsessed. I think he's incredible. So smart and so well thought of. And just reading about Safe, the way that he's kind of linking it to the way that as a contemporary society in the past, I would say 50 years, trying to grapple with these kind of waves of, I mean, it's more explicitly about AIDS epidemic, but you're also dealing with the coming of technology and all these other things and trying to find solutions to problems that are too big to have human solutions. And the way that he kind of tackles those ideas, bringing the context, just really tapping into the emotions of the moment as well, I think is just incredible. So I would highly recommend people check out his writing, which You can like, if you have time, if you don't have a job like I don't anymore, just like read all of his articles on Vanity Fair. You'll have a great time.
What's your Venmo, Justine?
I don't have, in Canada, we don't have Venmo. No, I have government. No. Yeah. We have amazing government support in Quebec and Canada as well. So I didn't get it the same afternoon, but I got my government money within 48 hours. So I'm good. Yeah. I'm not suffering.
What I think about when you talk about K. Austin Collins and his work is how fascinating it's been to look at all the different ways that the human brain copes at a time like this. And some people are just doing their best work and some people are stagnating. And I think it's really important to acknowledge any state that you're in and say that state's okay, that you don't have to be producing your great manuscript right now. Yeah, I guess, Kate, you would have a lot of insight into that working with your blacklist community. How are they? What's going on? What are their main concerns and what can you share?
Yeah, I was gonna make a terrible joke about like, well, I guess I'm gonna throw King Lear 2 in the bin. But I don't know how folks are feeling, but my creativity might as well not exist right now. So it's amazing to me that anybody is writing any sentences that make any sense, or maybe a paragraph or an essay that makes sense. You know, I think a lot of writers in particular are struggling to find the language for a time that has no precedent, that doesn't really have a language to define it yet. And it's just, I think it's a challenge to then sort of spark your own creative work and feel like you have any kind of gas left in the tank. I don't know. I'm glad people are starting to settle in and we're getting less on this like, oh, well, you haven't, you know, written a screenplay and watched 10 seasons of television and also gotten a six pack of abs. as you were just saying, Gemma, whatever folks are doing is fine. But yeah, you know, our community is hanging in there. I would say in America, the number one thing that we sort of hear from writers, aside from being unable to focus given the daily news cycle, is childcare and how helpful childcare would be to the life of a writer. Obviously not an option right now. When we think about, you know, this mythical when we come back, but when we sort of get things towards whatever our new state is going to be, figuring out these kind of ways that we can help and support artists beyond the art itself are going to be so crucial and so paramount to giving the artists that we love room to grow and expand after all of this.
And who is the film community person that you've been looking at this week?
People have been doing some really amazing stuff, so it's hard for me to pick one in particular. I will say I have to shout out my beloved Vidiots here in Los Angeles and video stores around the world. It's extremely difficult to be a video store right now for obvious reasons, but Vidiots has been doing every couple of days on social media. They have somebody who is a Vidiots board member or contributor or part of the Vidiots family walking you through their viewing during this time, and I think that's really nice to get a lot of different perspectives, because you have some people who are confronting it head on and are like, watch Contagion and Outbreak, and then other people who want nothing to do with that. So it's nice to get the full spectrum of sort of where people are at with this and what they're watching. So yeah, Vidiots, Instagram, Twitter, you will not be disappointed by that follow.
Love, love, love. For me, there's a campaign called Read a Letter that's been going around the social medias, and it's something that Benedict Cumberbatch has been involved in, where you've got, you know, quite a few notable people reading a letter that they would like us all to hear. And today for me, it was 92-year-old actor Joss Ackland, who has seen a lot of war. He's lived through a lot of decades, and he wanted to write a letter about his point of view as a 92-year-old man at this time. And it's worth seeking out. Frankly, I could just listen to old people gently telling young people off all day long right now, mainly because old people have been the most affected group by the coronavirus. And we don't see a lot of old people on social media because it's just a generational thing. And so it's always really gorgeous when, you know, a 92-year-old face pops up and says, hey, you know what? As an actor, I used to jump on the tube just to meet people and talk to them and hear about their lives and observe them. And now I walk down the street and you're all just looking down at your phones and your hands and, you know, stepping over the people on the street who need help. And this is just the latest crisis we're living through, and we need to do it together. And it's just, you know, it's just so lovely and sweet and just please, more old people can tell me off on social media. I mean, it's not a telling off, but you know what I mean? It's just a kind of like a lift your heads up and look around you. I really like that. I just want to really thank you both for coming on and sharing your thirsty horn dog tendencies in cinema. This was a great treat. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks for letting us be thirsty on Maine.
Anytime. I mean, we could just do this every week. This podcast is recorded in Los Angeles, Montreal, and Auckland in our homes and edited by Morgan Avery. The music is Hitchcock by the Phoenix Foundation. Our podcast artwork is by Anne Davenport. And my guests today were Kate Hagen and Justine Smith. Thank you both so much for coming on the Letterboxd Show. You'll find links for all the films and lists and articles we mentioned in the podcast description. If you'd like to leave a voice message for our next podcast, we'll be celebrating Steven Spielberg. Hit the link in the description and tell us your favourite Spielberg film and why. And you can find previous episodes of our podcast at letterboxd.show. Thanks so much for listening. Stay thirsty, but stay home.